it be? Do you mind if I mess you about? Can we start with the introduction? Page one, the word of the Buddha forward. Should be easy to find, it's the very beginning. To give people some advice on why I am translating as I am. Okay. Sorry? What page? One. The word of the Buddha forward in 1907. Go up, size, yeah. And up. Yay. Up, 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 up. Yay. Are you ready? Is everybody sitting comfortably? Then I will begin. If anybody has any trouble hearing, we do have some device somewhere which people can hear. And it's so powerful that once it's switched on, you get these little headphones. You can even hear the talks in the cottages. So you can actually sit down there in bed and listen to the talk without getting out of bed. Or on the toilet if you have some diarrhea or something. The compassion of this place knows no limits. But anyway, so you can see the managers or something if you, the hearing is a bit difficult for you. Now I'm just going to do this forward for you to the translations, such as the translation we did yesterday, where they came from, why they are, how they are. In 1907, it's a long time ago, the pioneering German-born monk Venerable Tiloka published the English version of the Word of the Buddha. It is described as an outline of the teachings of the Buddha in the words of the Pali Canon. It consists of a selection of authentic teachings from the suttas. The suttas was what was chanted at the first council and acknowledged as being the earliest strand of Buddhism available to us, that expound on the core Buddhist Dharma teachings of the Four Noble Truths, including the Noble Eightfold Path. And when I wrote this, it's probably longer now, for almost 20 years I had been using the Word of the Buddha as a textbook to introduce my monastic students, monks and nuns, to... Monastic students. Yeah, that's what I said. I said it. Indeed, every Anagarika Pachana and Samanera must complete this course in basic Buddhist teachings before they are allowed to receive a higher ordination as a bhikkhu. I have taken such steps to establish quality control in the monks under my training. So at the very least, they are made aware of what the Buddha really taught from the most reliable source, the Sutta. Unfortunately, there is a trouble. There's a problem. Although the Dharma is timeless, the usual presentation has become as if overgrown by impenetrable thickets of tradition. I have received countless well-intended criticisms that all the repetitions are discouraging, and the similes are so archaic as to be obtuse, which means you can't really penetrate, see through them. And some revered renderings of key Buddhist terms are rusted shut. The exegesis, the explanation, is well past its use by date. 1907, for goodness sake. Rather turn on the electric light than complain about darkness. An ancient Chinese saying, update it. Could you usually say, rather light a candle than complain about darkness? But how many of you would light a candle when it's electric light you can turn on? So this is an example. Rather turn on the electric light than complain about darkness. How we take some of these old proverbs and update them to keep the meaning but make it more relevant. This little book then is not another translation, it's a new type of translation. Not so much for detached scholars, but for those who immerse their whole lives in these teachings. I have followed Professor A.K. Warder, insightful advice. He was basically the one who taught me Pali from his books. It is the sentences which are the natural units of discourse, and which are the minimum units having precise, fully articulated meaning. For purposes of study, we have to assign approximate meanings to words and list these in vocabularies. But these generalized meanings of words are extremely vague, whereas sentences have exact meanings. In translation, one may find close equivalents for sentences, whilst it's often impossible to give close equivalents for words. We think, we speak, we live in sentences. And words are like abstractions, which have no real independent meaning, other than the words before and after them, which give them context. The sentence, that is what we should always translate, not the words. Thus, in order to convey the meaning, I have chosen to translate sentence for sentence, and not word for word. A word has no permanent essence outside of a sentence. I just said some of my authority to translate. For example, for many years I just skipped my authority to translate. My authority to translate rests on my reputation as a well-known Buddhist meditation teacher, trained to think in Cambridge University, and then trained to be silent for 9 years under Ajahn Chah, author of many books on meditation, teacher of Pali to many monks, and 45 years immersed in the life of a renunciant, open to scrutiny. It's most important that as a monk or as a nun, you're open to scrutiny. People can check you out. For example, for many years, I have consistently protested against the traditional translation of concentration for the Pali word samadhi, instead preferring the word stillness. This is not a trivial point for debate amongst philologists, the people who specialize in the meaning of words. It's not a trivial point, because it cuts to the very heart of the Buddhist path to freedom. Nor is my protest to serve an ego. Quite the opposite. The practice of concentration and the willpower on which it depends actually reinforces the ego. On the contrary, stillness and the letting go stroke renunciation on which it depends brings the ego to cessation. This is not the final version. Translations will always be work in progress. I only hope that this version will elucidate, inspire, and challenge. Students have remarked on listening to classes based on earlier drafts of this book that it is like listening to the teachings in the suttas for the first time, and their power is frightening and at the same time compelling. As for improvements, I welcome better sentence-by-sentence translations, but only when they arise from someone immersed in these teachings, living as the renunciant for the cessation of all ego or any concept of a permanent essence within or beyond the five khandhas. And afterwards, just one of my favorite quotes, Sabbe dhamma nalang abhi nivesanaya. There is nothing worth keeping. Okay, so that gives an idea why this translation you're seeing may be different than what you read in the suttas translated by scholars, meant for scholars rather than for practitioners. They are not word for word, sentence for sentence. So, just as usual, changing my plans and giving Hai Ling a hard time finding exactly where I'm going to speak next from this compilation of the Buddha's words translated into English. Can we actually go now, if you can find it, to the first time that Anapanasati is mentioned, and that is in the Satipatthana Sutta. So that goes way down to, keep on going down until you go to the path and the right mindfulness, which is, on my version, is somewhere around page, there we go, or page 37. Oh, I got on page 37, right mindfulness. Have you got that? Is that right mindfulness? What have you got there? Four folks above, yes. Now, having got that one, can you go up a little bit to the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path? Right restraint. You got that one? Okay. And this is one example of what you are doing. This is the basic Eightfold Path. The sixth factor of the Eightfold Path is usually translated as right effort. And for so many years, there was always troubling me as a monk, because when you put effort into meditate, your mind gets screwed up, really screwed up. And I don't know where Claire is, but remember the little thing which I exercised? I said, how can I keep this cup of water perfectly still? Put it down. Effortless. Trying to hold it still with effort. You can't do it. It's actually impossible. Because the effort is dynamic. It moves. It actually disturbs things. And there was always something, maybe previous life experiences as a monk, as a meditator, it never felt right. It was just too aggressive, too even violent, the effort which one put in to doing things. And also there was no joy there when there's effort. When the effort finished, maybe there was some joy. Because now you are free. And I also recall going to, as a young man, going to any retreat I could find, any meditation teacher, because I didn't have the luxury of choice in those days when I was young. And to see that people said, oh, look at this retreat. You can see them having the group photograph. They all look so happy. And I said, yes, because it's the last day of the retreat. Now they're going home and having an evening meal, and they can relax and sleep. They don't have to get up early in the morning. But if you took the group photograph in the middle of the retreat, and people were happy, now that is saying something. But anyway, that later on, I will see if we can get to it today. It's on those lists of sequences. You find that even something like the Eightfold Path, one thing leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another. As I mentioned, before you even can be aware of the breath, there's prerequisites, things you have to complete it first. The comfort of the body, no regrets, restraint, and it's the restraint which is my preferred translation for effort. Not any old effort, but the effort to stop, to say no, to give up, to put down, to stop grasping. So, usually we call the four right efforts, but now they become the four right restraints. And one of the other reasons I use this word, because there's a parallel path to the Eightfold Path called the gradual training. And in that gradual training, it's not effort, but it's called sense restraint. Those two cover the same ground. One in the Eightfold Path, one in the gradual path. Two different ways of saying the same thing. But anyway, I'm going to start with right restraint. And having done right restraint, then I will continue on to the right mindfulness, where we begin with the Buddha's first four steps of Anapanasati, the breath meditation. What now is right restraint? There are these four right restraints: guarding, abandoning, development, and preservation. And you may notice, as I read through this, that the reason they're restraints is like a non-doing, a preventing, a guarding. It's not going somewhere. It's actually staying where you are and making sure the mind doesn't go anywhere. It is the dog who keeps biting the pilot when he tries to do anything. That's the effort. No. Stop. Don't do anything. And what is the right restraint of guarding? It's the restraint of the five hindrances by guarding the senses. When you see an object, you do not let yourself get sucked in by any characteristics or features that generate defilements. Even that word, getting sucked in. Sucked in is almost like conned, you know, by some salesperson who's performing a scam on you, saying that this is beautiful. This is worthwhile. That person deserves, you know, your anger or ill will. It's a scam someone is playing on you, trying to convince you that they don't deserve forgiveness, or they deserve to be owned. I always sometimes thought it didn't really sound right in a relationship where you say it's my wife. As if you own her. Or it is, now you are mine. What it must be feel like if someone thinks they own and control you by some of these words. Anyway, it never sounded right there. But anyway, you don't get sucked in. So you see an object, you do not let yourself get sucked in by any characteristics or features that generate defilements. So if you left the faculty of sight unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting, and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom when seeing, and you guard the faculty of sight, and you undertake the restraint of sight, so you don't get sucked in by the sales pitch of the first sense. Having heard a sound, noticed a smell, sensed a taste, having felt a bodily feeling, even having cognized something in the mind, you don't let yourself get sucked in by any characteristics or features that generate defilements. Since if you left the mind faculty unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom with the mind. You guard the mind, and you undertake the restraint of the mind. This is called the restraint of guarding the senses. And just as personal anecdotes, I shared this with somebody in one of the interviews earlier on, that I was a young monk, I was heterosexual, I wasn't born a monk. So of course, you know, you see, especially, you know, beautiful young ladies coming. I was only 23 when I became a monk. And sometimes, you know, they were very beautiful. But I was very concerned because they used to say in those Thai forest monasteries many years ago that you don't need to be afraid of the tigers roaming in the jungle. What you used to be afraid of?
Tiger.
What?
Tiger.
Girls, put it down on the end. Thai girls kill many more monks than tigers. And it was just, you know, what was in your hormones, your genes. And so you had to sort of use the restraint of the senses. I love my meditation. So if you saw somebody really liked, this is no criticism or misogynist, whatever. It is, if I saw a beautiful girl, I would try and look deliberately for something in her which was an imperfection. And the thing I used to look for was a pimple. And I would look and say, oh yeah, there's one there. What that did, it went to a feature which stopped that I wanted to own this. If I saw somebody who was very offensive to me and very easy to get aversion towards them, then I'd look for something which would create some loving kindness and metta. So I would use this to balance, you know, my reaction to a person. To see something, I was just talking earlier to someone whose family member recently got converted to being a Christian. And sometimes it can be very upsetting for them. But if something which creates aversion for you, then look for something which creates some kindness, some goodness, to balance your perceptions. And you know, the thing was that it's only temporary. So we call it temporary insanity. They can convert one way, they can always convert back again. So, you don't need to get upset. So things which make you upset, look for some other part, some other feature, which balances your reaction. That's called restraint to guarding the senses. Only so you can have a peaceful mind. Restraint of the five hindrances by abandoning. Because when we say restraint of what? And this is actually the five hindrances we are restraining. And I will say how that leads on to the next stage, which is the right mindfulness. But first of all, restraint of the five hindrances by abandoning. What is a restraint by abandoning? Here, you do not maintain an arisen thought of wanting. You abandon it, let it go, renounce it, bring it to cessation. Because sometimes people have a wandering mind. And the thought comes up, what do you do with it? You don't follow it. You followed those thoughts for so many years. Where do they lead? Do they really get you anywhere? So, but anyway, it comes in a few moments, a whole sutta on how to abandon thoughts. You do not indulge an arisen thought of ill will. If you have ill will towards someone, they've really upset you, you have a look at that, and you look at some other features to create some loving kindness for them. If someone really disappoints me, I try and be their defense lawyer. In other words, try and get them off the charge. Try and find some means of excusing them. Instead of, whenever I used to get angry a long time ago, I got angry at somebody. They let me down. Why did they let me down? They should have been there on time. And I notice I'm acting like a prosecutor in a trial, looking at all the terrible things they must have done and the reasons why they deserve to be judged guilty. When I get angry and try and justify my ill will, even before the defense attorney says anything, I act as the prosecutor and the judge, bang, the gong, guilty. That didn't work, did it? Guilty. That didn't work either, anyway. But I thought that was really unfair. So whenever I was about to get angry at somebody for doing something I didn't like, I decided to be the defense attorney as well. They must have been in a bad mood that day. Maybe they thought they were doing the right thing. Maybe they were tired. Maybe I didn't really understand what they said. Maybe they tried to get there on time, but you know, they're caught in traffic or something. I don't know why. So that means that I restrain the ill will by abandoning those trains of thoughts. Anyway, there's a whole sutta on the ways to abandon distracting thoughts, Vitakavichara Sutta. Now, one of the problems with my approach of translating sentences rather than words and stopping repetition is that a sutta, which was usually many pages long, now becomes a paragraph. When you take out all the repetition, there's not much there, but you get the essence. So this is the 20th sutta, just taking the essence out. I'm not saying what the Buddha was saying here and somebody asked him this. This is a teaching. So this is how to restrain by abandoning unwholesome thoughts. Or when you are mindful of some object and there arises in you disturbing, troublesome thoughts, connected with desire, aversion, or delusion, any of those. So this is when you're meditating, your mind is wandering off somewhere, thinking about all sorts of weird stuff, or thinking about, you know, anger because somebody stopped you getting enlightened. You were just about to get into jhana this morning, and at 6 o'clock, Ajahn Brahm rang the bell. Oh. I often think, what would have happened if there was a gong under the Bodhi tree when the Buddha was trying to get enlightened? Gong. That is one of the reasons why I don't actually ring the gong like that. I do like the singing bowl. It's much softer. But even that, have you ever been to those retreats? I remember going to those retreats with a bell to get up in the morning, a bell to actually have breakfast, a bell to finish breakfast, a bell to listen to the talk, there's bells all over the place. Hell's bells. So that's one of the reasons why I dispensed with bells when I started teaching. So you can meditate when you want. So what do we call this? This is called, we practice here, no bell silence. That's what noble silence means. You got a question? Okay.
With reference to the taking the repetition,
yeah.
Does it take away the meaning of the repetition?
Good question. It doesn't take away the meaning. It makes the meaning stand out. It makes it clearer. It highlights the meaning. Because the repetition, people say, I've heard that. Especially people in our modern world are very impatient. So they're waiting for the next part of the Eightfold Path, instead of hearing the same again and again and again and again. So in psychology, people want to hear clearly. And if there's too much repetition, it's almost disrespecting them. I've heard that. Come on. What's the next word? I've heard that. What's the next word? I've heard that already. I don't need to know it once again. How many times do I need to hear this? I've heard this so many times. I've heard it again and again. How many times do I have to hear it? Do you get the example? So anyway, it's usually much better to have the teaching clear, precise, simplified. It becomes more powerful. Anyway, so when you're mindful of some object that arises you disturbing, troublesome thoughts connected with desire, aversion, delusion, then number one, two, three, four, five. Number one, you should give attention to some other object that generates peaceful mind states. Thus, disturbing thoughts are abandoned and subside, and with their disappearance, your mind becomes internally settled. Steady, so internally steady, settled, unified, and still. Now, hear that this is what we call the substitution. So, you know, your mind is upset about something. So you substitute, you know, thinking about this person with aversion with thinking about, you know, their beautiful side. You don't look at the two bad bricks in the wall, you look at the good bricks in the wall. And before you keep asking me, like many people ask me on a retreat when they come here for the first time, Ajahn Brahm, where are those two bad bricks? And I get sort of, okay, here we go again. I get repetition and I get fed up with that. So I understand about repetition. Those two bad bricks, I sort of wondered, I lost them for a while because they were no longer important to me. You know, I was looking at the good bricks now. And so instead of standing out, now, even thinking about them or looking at them, then they vanish. And then people ask me afterwards, where are they? And I had to go looking for them. Because I knew they were in the first building, which I helped build, which was actually the ablution block. And I went looking in and out there, and I finally found them in the monk's side of the ablution block. And you know, I was responsible for those two bricks. And they are crooked, but, and I said, well, I found them, but I'm sorry, but I can't lead a guided tour into the, into the monk's toilet block. And anyway, so what, they're there. So I said, well, I want to take a photo of them. Oh, enough photos. But anyway, that's, by putting attention on the good bricks, of course, then the, you don't overemphasize and get sucked in with the bad features. So, you're mindful, so you try and change the object to something which is more peaceful and more beautiful and more still and settling. Or, if that doesn't work, you examine the danger in those thoughts. Because at first you don't see the danger. At first you think you're in control of this. It's harmless. And that's why sometimes when people, they have problems in their relationships, at first they think that's only a bit of fun, a bit of flirting, a bit of banter, that's all it is. Then one thing leads to another, and to another, and to another, and to another, and before you know it, you're in big trouble. Or you're like drugs. I'm just experimenting. I'm in control. It's just a puff of marijuana or something. And before you know it, you're addicted to the harder drugs. And in my experience, when I was a student, I was really fortunate because of, first of all, it was because, I'm just, this is off subject here, but it's good to to be open to everybody. And when I first was a young man, about A-level time, a few of my friends started taking marijuana. And of course I was tempted, because peer pressure. But then one day one of my best friends, on the bus going back from school to home, he said that he'd been caught. And that he said his life was a real mess now, because his parents had been told by the headmaster. And he was facing a lot of trouble. At that time, my father was really sick. He would die about 6 months later. And I thought, I can't do that to my father, to cause him such worry and concern that, you know, that he, you know, that would probably maybe tip him over the edge. Because, you know, when someone is really sick, they're on the edge like that. So I said no to it. It was just because of love for my father, basically. It was only later, when I got to university, and then of course my father was dead, and got tempted again. But that's when I became a Buddhist, and started meditating. I was a Buddhist before, sorry. But I started meditating, and the teachers always said, no, it just messes up your mind. And I wanted my mind to be peaceful and clear. And then, of course, you know, you did see some of your friends from school who carried on. And there was one friend, and oh, it's just, okay, maybe one example, maybe this doesn't happen to everybody. But this fellow, he was a genius. He went to medical school at Cambridge. But at medical school, you know, there was too many temptations in the medicine cabinet, and became a heroin addict. And this poor fellow eventually everyone tried everything to help him. And when, as a heroin addict, they came to visit, you know, the friends, I was in Thailand at the time, the other friends said, look, we just can't help him at all. It's a disease, and he just steals from us. He has to, his best friends, because he needs the money to feed his addiction. And I went to visit UK once, and I met with this fellow. You know, he could have been a great surgeon or doctor. He had such skill, and he was just making a living just by just doing gardening in people's houses. I thought that was just a real waste, because it was a friend, a close friend. And I just, when I saw that, the dangers are too great. That's what it says here. Examine the dangers in those disturbing thoughts. And don't think you are better and you're in control, that you can handle this. Maybe you can, I don't know, but there's really good chance you won't, and you'll end up in a lot of problems and troubles. So, the danger in these disturbing thoughts, and what do you want in your life anyway? Some peace, some happiness. So, that's why. Thoughts, the danger in them, what's going to happen if I carry on like this? You should try to ignore those disturbing thoughts, not give attention to them, which is also a wonderful thing. Oh, those thoughts, just one of the reasons why when you have a very peaceful state of mind, it's so easy not to give attention to the sounds. This is what Ajahn Chah meant when he said, the noise doesn't disturb you, you're the one who disturbs the noise. What did he mean by that? Somebody, just when you're meditating this afternoon or something, somebody bangs the door again. And you think, who was that? I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm, are we going to blacklist them? We're going to make sure they're not allowed to come on any retreats. Because they're always really noisy. They're just so unmindful and so uncareful. And you can see that's a legitimate train of thought, or is it? Because the sound of the banging of the door stopped a long time ago. And it's still echoing in your mind. And it is the echo, the thinking about that sound, that is the main disturbance. Bang the door, bang, it's over, finished. But the way you think about it afterwards, that is the problem. That is a disturbance. So you ignore those disturbances. Oh, bang the door, finished. You can't unbang it. And so those are some ways that we can ignore them. Don't give them such importance. And if that doesn't work, give attention to stilling the causes that created those thoughts. And that's one of the ones I'm always really interested in. Why did those thoughts come in the first place? Stop trying to suppress the thoughts. See if you can deal with what caused those thoughts. And that's especially true in meditation. I've said already that sometimes you get a thought comes into your mind from nowhere. And that is just not true. You brought that thought in. You checked in your filing cabinet, as it were, of distractive thoughts, and think what one you're going to amuse yourself with this afternoon. And there's no end of those fantasies, dreams, and they're not always pleasant. Sometimes, you know, you go into something, which a terrible thing which happened in the past. Or even worse these days, people go into these television dramas, which they get so engrossed in. The last time I went to visit Indonesia, everybody was talking about Avengers and this superpower person who was going to kill half the population of the world. You're supposed to be meditating. That's a fantasy. But when it came to the Q&A, I was getting all these questions about, what's it called? Is it Thor? No. Thanos. That's right, Thanos. Because that's, you know, that's the word for death, like euthanasia. So, you know, you means good. And Thanos means death. It's a Greek word. So, Thanos, what do you think? If you were Thanos, would you do that to help the climate control and get rid of all the troublemakers in this world? Have a list of all the people who ask me cheeky questions, and you're the first on the list. But you can see how corrupt that can be. If you were Thanos, they said, who would be the first person on your list to delete from humanity? It's interesting questions. So anyway, the disturbing thoughts. So the cause of those thoughts, and it's not just they come from nowhere. It is that you're bored. You're not satisfied. You're not content. You're not happy, basically. And that's why we turn on the TV, see what's on TV. That's why I said you go to the refrigerator. Find us one in the refrigerator. Get something to eat. There's too much already. We just go, anything. We're so restless. Why? In that chant that we chant in the morning and in the evening, this is what should be done. There's a phrase in there which is one of the most beautiful phrases. To be content and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. That is like a koan. That is so amazingly powerful. To be content when you're meditating. Don't try and get jhanas or enlightenment. Just be content. You're having a peaceful mind, being able to sit here with no one telling you what to do. No boss, no husband, no wife, no kids screaming at you, no, nothing to do. To be content. Isn't this wonderful? Just being here, beautiful retreat center, great food, funny monk, I hope, inspiring nun, and just comfortable rooms. Be content and easily satisfied. Wow, this is enough for me. In the whole world, people are always telling you to get more, 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 more. More money, more possessions, more health, more, I don't know what else, what you want. But this is good enough for me. I'm satisfied with this for 7 days. You can go back to work afterwards when you leave. But while you're here, satisfied with this. Oh, great. Not proud. Now that's a big one. because we want to achieve. When you leave this retreat, people will ask you, how did it go? And you'll feel so terrible if you didn't get jhanas. Stupid, isn't it? Oh, you went with Ajahn Brahm. Oh, you paid all that money. Oh, what did you get for it? Nothing. Did the, who was organizing this? Buddhist Fellowship or Bodhinyana Singapore? Who was organizing? Or both? Bodhinyana Singapore. Did you give the money back guarantee? If you don't get first dharma, you can get your money back? Just as well. You get broke. So, sometimes because of pride, we think, I better get something to tell my partner, to tell my friends. I went on this retreat. Wow, I got so much. A bit disappointing, because getting a holiday, 7 days or 10 days off work, coming to a nice peaceful place, people always think you should get something. That's called conceit. Wanting something for me. So that's why Ajahn Chah would always say, great saying, you meditate, you come to a place like this to let go of things, not to get anything. To see how much you can lessen your wanting, your cravings, your needs, so you don't need so much to be happy in life. And aversion, let go of all those who will. Thinking about your ex. Remember, you may hate your ex, but you are their ex. So it may be going both ways. Or getting rid of grief or whatever. So in the end, we just let that go. Not to achieve anything, but see how much we can abandon. And that's actually what we're doing here. This is abandoning stuff. So you go back to where you originated from and you are more peaceful, more free. I haven't got things, but I've let go of so much. This is the rubbish dump of the mind. Leave your rubbish here and go home rubbish free. Deposit your trash in Jhana Grove. Your mental trash, that is. Not your other trash. So the cause of these things, and also content, easy, satisfied, not proud, and demanding in nature. And some people, it's never enough. You can always have more. But the way of the Buddha is being contented and satisfied. This is enough for me. Good enough. And when you're happy to be here, the simile, which will maybe come later on, of a prison. Okay, a simile comes up now, just it fits in. That the monk who years ago went to visit the prison, the new top security prison, Casuarina, and prisoners there liked him. They asked him to stay behind for a little bit longer. And they chatted to him, not about meditation, about life as a Buddhist monk. I won't go in details because it's another story which I think you can read in the books. You've heard it many times before. But in brief, that they discovered that the life in a Buddhist monastery in Bodhinyana was far more austere than the life in a top security prison in Australia. You get to watch the TV and football and movies. You don't get to watch them here. I've got to actually ask, you know, who was this Thanos and find out, you know, what they're all talking about. And food. They have 3, 4, 5 meals a day in prison. We've got to do with 2. And if we get something wrong in our bowl, that's why. You know, it's absolutely true that sometimes I've had some of the strangest of meals. Strawberry ice cream on spaghetti bolognese. How did that happen? Well, you know, that we went in the line there, we put, you know, the things in our bowl, and then I usually, you know, give it to another person to take up the stairs. It's supposed to be good merit for them. But sometimes they're a little bit, you know, careless, and it sort of puts the ice cream in one place, and when I open the bowl, it's moving on top of the spaghetti bolognese. You get spaghetti on the spaghetti, and you get custard on top of curry. And they said, that's disgusting! In prison, they say, even in solitary confinement, they give things on a tray. So anyway, it was all sorts of stuff. I sleep on the floor in my cave. I've only got a cave to sleep in. And anyway, we do it. And they said, they actually were really concerned about their friend living such a rough, tough life in a Buddhist monastery. And that's when they said, that's terrible where you live. And they said, why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? We invite you to hang out in prison for a few weeks. And then you can have a bit of peace and quiet. But it was a funny, but then why do people like staying in Bodhinyana Monastery? There is always a waiting list there of people trying to get in. Why? And there is a waiting list, so I'm told, in prison, of people trying to get out. What's the difference? The difference is only one thing. In a monastery or a retreat center, you want to be here. In prison, you don't want to be here. That opened up this beautiful how to overcome distracting thoughts. When you're meditating, do you want to be here? You're watching the breath, you really want to be here? Or do you want the nimittas? Come on, I've done the breath for too long. Where's the nimittas coming? It means you don't want to be here. You've made a prison for yourself. If you are meditating, been meditating for years and you're still not enlightened yet, that is terrible, not being enlightened. And so people actually, they don't lie, but they bend the truth. Well, you know, just I've let go of the wish for enlightenment. I'm sort of half enlightened. The spiritual goals create wanting. There's always another goal to reach. In other words, the wanting never finishes. So instead, we finish the wanting. Happy to be here. Now, if in your meditation, anywhere in your life you want a bit of peace and quiet, even if you're sick and in pain on your deathbed, remember those words. If you want to be free, even in pain and sickness, do you want to be here? You can't get out of this. It's beyond your ability to get rid of that pain or that impending death. Why not change the attitude? You can do that. I want to be here. This is good enough for me. I'm not going to be demanding in nature. I'm not going to be proud as if I can control the world. Can't even control my own body. I'm happy to be here. Wow! Your meditation just goes really deep, almost immediately. Because you're paying attention to the cause of the creative those thoughts. Cutting off the cause of wanting something else. You want to be here, you're free. Thoughts stop. Nothing to think about. You're happy being here. It's good enough for me. That is cutting off the causes of those thoughts. And if that doesn't work, you're pretty a hopeless case. Clench your teeth with your tongue pressed against the roof of your mouth. And beat down, constrain, and crush any disturbing thoughts. I say only as a last resort, because that usually doesn't work. What it does is stop you doing stupid things. With the disappearance of them, your mind becomes internally steady, settled, unified, and still. Restrain the five hindrances by developing the other way of restraining, stopping unwholesome thoughts is to fill your mind up with wholesome thoughts. If you've got a house and you're away for a week, one of the best security is having all your good friends over there. If you fill up your house with, you know, really good friends, people you trust, in the house sit, Bertha comes along, oh, okay, good people in the house, I'll go to another empty house, it's easier. So by putting your mind with beautiful thoughts, any beautiful thoughts, that stops the unwholesome ones. And I just give like the enlightened factors here, but there's other thoughts as well. Remembering all your past acts of kindness, or other people's past acts of kindness. You know, sometimes when you see someone do a compassionate act, really kind act, I try and remember that. A wise act. And it brings me like joy and happiness in this world. And when I put that joy and happiness in this world, the bad thoughts can't come up. It is, I don't know why this one comes up, but I read this in a newspaper that Islamic justice. There was a woman who was caught stealing a breadfruit from the market in a small town in Sumatra. And according to the Islamic law, that the stallholder could decide or not decide to forgive her or to punish her. He decided to punish her because he said, look, if I let one person steal from my store, I have to make a living as well, and everybody else will. They'll think I'm a soft touch. So had to take her in front of the magistrate. And the magistrate said, well, you know, why? Why did, oh, first of all, did you steal the breadfruit? He said, yes, I did. Why? And she said, because my husband had run away to Jakarta, hadn't come back. She had a couple of kids, and it was to feed her kids. She was poor, and they had nothing to eat. And any of you who've read the Les Miserables by Victor Hugo, you'd remember that. Just when the Jean-Paul Jeanne, when he was sent to the prison ships, why? He stole a loaf of bread. Why? To feed my family. And I don't know about you, but when I heard that, that was, wow, do you have to put someone in jail for that? And it was just, would you do that for your kids? You know, to feed them when they're really hungry? There's something about parental that you almost do anything for your kids if they're really suffering. But anyway, in this modern day magistrate, he said, can't you forgive her? Her kids were hungry. No! So the judge had to say, madam, you're guilty. And the fine will be, I think it was like the equivalent of $100 US. And the poor lady, she couldn't even afford to buy a meal for her kids. So she hung her head and she started weeping. But, said the judge, I will also use my authority to fine every person in this courtroom, there's about 100 people there, $10 US each, or the equivalent, for being so heedless, you allowed a poor mother to have to steal to feed her kids. You should not allow that situation of poverty to exist in this town. So every one of you, and there's about 100 people in there, are culpable, including me, said the judge. And he passed the hat around, and everyone in that courtroom had to pay $10 fine. And then he took $100 to pay the fine, and then he gave 900 bucks, the equivalent in rupiah, to the poor woman, and say, here, feed your kids. And I thought, wow, that is beautiful justice. Wisdom, compassion, to actually, when somebody does a crime like that, we're all culpable. They're in our poverty to exist in our midst. So anyway, I thought that was inspiring. So when I have a thought like that, that just, wow, it just inspires me. I don't know if it inspires you. And then you meditate. No distracting thoughts. Because a lot of time, when we get really upset, negative, depressed, that's one of the causes for distracting thoughts. You know, we watch some movies or something just to distract ourselves. Because life is suffering, and we just can't see any way out of it. So anyway, by putting good things in the mind, reflections of a Buddha. Anyway, the last one is, what is it? By maintaining a positive mind state. Here you keep in mind an arisen meditation object that generates stillness, such as recollecting the Buddha. If you've got a feeling for what the Buddha is, or you go to the sites where the Buddha lived, and I can just visualize, you know, the Vulture's Peak. You can keep those visions in mind. Not sort of people, you know, made me angry or made me upset, did the wrong things, but the beautiful things in life. Or the Dharma, the Sangha, your own acts of generosity, or others' acts of generosity, loving kindness, the breath is, you know, really getting in there. That's called restraint by maintaining good states. It's not an effort, it's like getting rid of stuff. It's a wisdom power, restraining. And anyway, always go way over time. So, the right mindfulness is restraining the hindrances by those four ways, what is it called again? By guarding, abandoning, developing and maintaining. Okay, now, can we go up to right mindfulness? Because this is where the segue comes. What now is right mindfulness? The four focuses of mindfulness leading one direction only to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, to the attainment of the true way for the realization of nirvana, what for? I rush through that because the next part is what I'm going to stop on this because it's just gone past five. The four satipatthanas. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindfulness, and mindful. And the same with abide aware of experience. I call it experience rather than feeling. I'll explain that later. You're aware of the mind, you're aware of mind objects. But you see, every one of those four satipatthanas starts with the words lokeya abhijja, vinaya lokeya abhijja domanasan. In the old translations, having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world. But if you look carefully, and actually in my notes, I've done all of the pointing to why it means abandoning, or rather having restrained the five hindrances first. Because the lokeya abhijja is a synonym for kamachanda, the first hindrance. Domanasa is in two places where it refers to the second hindrance, usually vayapada or ill will. And in the commentaries to both the Mahasatipatthana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, in the Majjhima 10, the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, in both places the commentaries say specifically this term means having restrained the five hindrances. So that's what I put down here. Having restrained the five hindrances, then you do the satipatthana. That is why the previous stage, right effort or right restraint, its whole purpose is to weaken and restrain the five hindrances. And how do you do the five hindrances? It's not just the right restraint. It's also the right livelihood, the right action, the right speech. That also serves to weaken those five hindrances. Even the right motivation, the second factor, that also, coming from a non-self, renunciation, kindness, gentleness, the old make peace, be kind, be gentle, which you see on t-shirts, they say, make peace, be kind, be gentle, Ajahn Brahm. It is not Ajahn Brahm, that's from the Buddha, that's the second factor of the Eightfold Path. all coming from right view. These factors, they support one another. So right restraint of the senses, that empowers you to start the mindfulness. The mindfulness is now strong when the five hindrances are weakened. This is the preliminary practice before you even start Satipatthana. And the first Satipatthana you will see there is the breath meditation. That's why I do a lot of focus on what you do even before you start watching the breath. Otherwise, you'll be one of those people who say, yeah, I tried breath meditation, it doesn't work. Because you did not follow the instructions. You rushed ahead too fast instead of realizing when those five hindrances are rampant. You can watch the breath through force for a little while, but you can't do it in the way the Buddha intended. Peacefully, kind, with joy. There we go. Part three. This is on Anapanasati. I haven't even mentioned the breath yet, but it's coming tomorrow. Sadhu. 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 Bringing joy up.